We are taking a little break to organize WITS, our Word Theater in the Schools program. So while we are off working, please enjoy our rebroadcasts of our podcasts featuring stories by Joyce Carol Oates. If you're enjoying what you hear here, please send us an email to admin@wordtheater.org. If you're looking for an internship, also please get in touch with us. And always spread the word that the word is Word Theater. Can you imagine what the world would look like if everyone joined us on our mission to make a better world, one story at a time? Welcome to episode 11 of the Word Theater Podcast, your weekly access to short stories read by world-class actors and recorded live with the writers in the room to hear their stories brought to life. My name is Cedaring Fox. I am Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
And I'm Kirsty Peart, UK founder and creative partner. For the next 7 weeks, we'll be sharing stories from Word Theatre's archive by one of America's finest authors, the internationally renowned Joyce Carol Oates.
We're very excited that she will be joining us at our next Word Theatre Live Zoom on April 18th to participate in a Q&A after the performance.
If you're enjoying our free weekly Word Theatre podcast, we hope you'll join our circle of cultural champions by becoming an enthusiast or patron member. We're a non-profit organization trying to make a better world one story at a time.
This week, we begin our seven-week celebration of stories by the remarkable Joyce Carol Oates. In addition to being one of the world's most prolific and honored writers, she is a tireless advocate for great writing. Ms. Oates was a founding editor of the Pushcart Prize in 1976. And it is in these 45 volumes of the Pushcart Prize where Word Theater has found so many of our favorite writers and our favorite stories.
The first story I'll share is an ebullient one that crackles with youthful energy and makes me smile. To introduce three girls, please welcome the wonderful actress who read it, Samantha Mathis.
Reading Three Girls was pure pleasure. Joyce Carol Oates has written a timeless love story to being young, to books, to New York City, to memories, and to magic. I do wonder if it's based on something she actually experienced, because I almost feel like it happened to me. That's the power of a brilliant story. What might have been an ordinary outing to the Strand bookstore becomes an enchanting adventure that brings the past into the present with all the tingles of young love. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed performing it.
In Strand Used Books, on Broadway and 12th, one snowy March early evening in 1956, when the streetlights on Broadway glimmered with a strange sepia glow, we were two NYU girl poets, drifting through the warehouse of treasures as through an enchanted forest. Just past 6 p.m., above light-riddled Manhattan, opaque night, snowing, and sidewalks encrusted with ice, so there were fewer customers in the Strand than usual at this hour. But there we were, among other cranky, brooding regulars, in our army surplus jackets, baggy khaki pants, and zip-up rubber boots, in our matching wool caps, knitted by your restless fingers, pulled down low over our pale girl foreheads, enchanted by books, enchanted by the Strand. No bookstore, merely new books with elegant show window displays, drew us like the drafty Strand. Bins of books, untidy and thumbed through as merchant sidewalk bins on 14th Street, new this week. Best bargains, world classics, art books, 50% off, reviewers' copies, highest price, $1.98, remainders, 25 cents to a dollar, hardcover, paperback, spotless, battered, beautiful books, cheaply printed pulp paper. And at the rear and sides in that vast echoing space, massive shelves of books, books, books rising to a ceiling of hammered tin, 15 feet above, stacked shelves so high they required ladders to negotiate and a monkey nimbleness like yours to climb. We were enchanted with the Strand and with each other in the Strand, overseen by surly young clerks who were poets like us, or playwrights, actors, artists. In an agony of unspoken love, I watched you. As always on these romantic evenings at the Strand, prowling the aisles, sneering at those luckless books, so many of them unworthy of your attention. Bestsellers, how-tos, arts and crafts, two simple histories of women's romances, sentimental love poems, patriotic books, middlebrow books, books lacking esoteric covers. We were girl poets, passionately enamored of T.S. Eliot, but scornful of Robert Frost, who we'd been made to memorize in high school. Slyly, we communicated in code phrases from Eliot in the presence of obtuse others in our dining hall and residence. We were admiring of, though confused by the poetry of Yeats. We were yet more confused by the lauded worth of Pound, enthusiastically drawn to the bold metaphors of Kafka, that cockroach, and Dostoevsky, sexy murderer Raskolnikov and the underground man were our rebel heroes, and Sartre, hell is other people, we knew this, and had reason to believe that we were their lineage, though admittedly we were American, middle class, and Caucasian, and female. Yet we were not conventional females. In fact, we shared male contempt for the merely conventional female. Brooding above a tumble of books that quicken the pulse, almost shyly touching Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents, Crane Brinton's The Age of Reason, Margaret Mead's Coming of Age in Samoa, D.H. Lawrence's The Rainbow, Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling, Mann's Death in Venice. There, you suddenly glided up behind me to touch my wrist, as you'd never done before, had you? And whispered, come here, in that way that thrilled me for its meaning, I have something wonderful, unexpected, startling to show you. Like poems, these discoveries in the Strand were to us found poems to be cherished. And eagerly, I turned to follow you, though disguising my eagerness. Yes, what? As if you'd interrupted me, for possibly we'd had a quarrel earlier that day, a flaring up of tense girl tempers. Yes, you were childish and self-absorbed and given to sulky silences and mercurial moods in the presence of showy, superficial people. And I adored you and feared you, knowing you'd break my heart that had never before been broken because never before so exposed. So eagerly, and yet with my customary guardedness, I followed you through a maze of book bins and shelves and stacks to the ceiling, anthropology, art ancient, art renaissance, art modern, art Asian, art Western, travel, philosophy, cookery, poetry, modern, where the way was treacherously lighted only by bare 60-watt bulbs, and where customers, as cranky as we two, stood in the aisles reading books, or sat hunched on footstools, glancing up, annoyed at our passage. And unquestioning, I followed you until at Poetry Modern you halted and pushed me ahead and around a corner, and I stood puzzled, staring, not knowing what I was supposed to be seeing until impatiently you poked me in the ribs and pointed, and now I perceived an individual in the aisle pulling down books from shelves, peering at them, clearly absorbed by what she read, a woman nearly my height, I was tall for a girl in 1956, in a man's navy coat to her ankles and with sleeves past her wrists, a man's beige fedora hat on her head scrunched low as we wore our knitted caps, and most of her hair hidden by that hat, except for a 6-inch blonde plait at the nape of her neck. And she wore black trousers tucked into what appeared to be salt-stained cowboy boots. Someone we knew, an older, good-looking student from one of our classes, a girl poet like ourselves. I was about to nudge you in the ribs in bafflement when the blonde woman turned, taking down another book from the shelf. E.E. Cummings' Tulips in Chimneys, always I would remember that title. And I saw that she was Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe in the Strand. Just like us. And she seemed to be alone. Marilyn Monroe alone. Wholly absorbed in browsing amid books, oblivious of her surroundings and of us, no one seemed to have recognized her yet, except you. Here was the surprise. This woman was not Marilyn Monroe, for this woman was an individual wholly absorbed in selecting, leafing through, pausing to read books. You could see that this individual was a reader, one of those who reads. And it was poetry she was reading. Her lips pursed, silently shaping words. Absent-mindedly, she wiped her nose on the edge of her hand, so intent she was on what she was reading. For when you truly read poetry, poetry reads you. Still, this woman was Marilyn Monroe. And despite our common sense, our scorn for silly cliches of Hollywood romance, still we half expected a leading man to join her. Clark Gable, Robert Taylor, Marlon Brando. Halfway, we expected the syrupy surge of movie music to glide us into the scene. But no man joined Marilyn Monroe in her disguise as one of us in the Strand. No leading man, no dark prince. Like us, we began to see this Marilyn Monroe required no man. For what seemed like a long time, it was probably no more than half an hour, Marilyn Monroe browsed in the Poetry Modern shelves, as from a distance of approximately 10 feet, we two girl poets watched, covertly clutching each other's hands. We were stunned to see that this woman looked very little like the glamorous Marilyn Monroe. That figure was a garish blonde showgirl, a Hollywood sexpot of no interest to intellectuals. We thought, we who knew nothing of the secret romance between Marilyn Monroe and Arthur Miller, this figure more resembled us, almost, than she resembled her Hollywood image. We were dying of curiosity to see whose poetry books Marilyn Monroe was examining. Elizabeth Bishop, H.D., Robert Lowell, Muriel Rukeyser, Harry Crosby, Denise Levertov. 5 or 6 of these, Marilyn Monroe decided to purchase and then moved on, leather bag slung over her shoulder and fedora tilted down on her head. We couldn't resist. We had to follow. Cautious not to whisper together like excited schoolgirls, still less to giggle wildly as we were tempted. You nudged me in the ribs to sober me, gave me a glare signaling, "Don't be rude, don't ruin this for all of us." I conceded. I was the more pushy of the two of us. A tall, gawky Rima the Bird girl with springy, carrot-red hair like an exotic bird's nest, while you were petite and dark-haired and attractive with long-lashed, Semitic slow eyes. You the wily gymnast, and I the aggressive basketball player. You the experimental poet, and I drawn to forms. Our contrary talents bred in our bones. Which of us would marry, have babies, disappear into real life, and which of us would persevere into her 30s before starting to be published and becoming, in time, a real poet? Could anyone have predicted this snowy March evening in 1956? Marilyn Monroe drifted through the maze of books, and we followed in her wake as through a maze of dreams, past sports, past military, past war, past history, ancient, past the familiar figures of Strand regulars frowning into books, past surly, yawning, bearded clerks who took no more heed of the blonde actress than they did of us, and so to natural history, where she paused, and then again, for unhurried minutes, the Strand was open until 9 p.m. Marilyn Monroe, in her mannish disguise, browsed and brooded, pulling down books, seeking what? At last crouched, leafing through an oversized illustrated book. Curiosity overcame me. I shoved away your restraining hand. Politely, I eased past Marilyn Monroe, murmuring, "Excuse me," without so much as brushing her hand and without being noticed. Charles Darwin's Origin of Species in a deluxe edition. Darwin, Origin of Species. We were poet despisers of science. Or believed we were or must be to be true poets in the exalted mode of T.S. Eliot and William Butler Yeats. Such a choice for Marilyn Monroe seemed perverse to us. But this was the one Marilyn quickly decided to purchase, hoisting it in her arms and moving on. That rakish fedora we'd come to covet, that single, chunky, blonde braid. Afterward, we would wonder, Marilyn Monroe's hair in a braid? Never had we seen Marilyn Monroe with her hair braided in any movie or photo. What did this mean? Did it mean anything? Had she quit films and embarked on a new anonymous life in our midst? Suddenly, Marilyn Monroe glanced back at us, frowning as a child might frown. Had we spoken aloud? Had she heard our thoughts? And there came into her face a look of puzzlement, not alarm or annoyance, but a childlike puzzlement. Who are you? You two, are you watching me? Quickly, we moved away. We were engaged in a whispering dispute over a book one of us had fumbled from a shelf, A History of Botanical Gardens in England. So we were undetected, we hoped. But wary now, and sobered, for what if Marilyn Monroe had caught us and knew that we knew? She might have abandoned her books and fled the Strand. Oh, what a loss for her and for the books, for us too. Oh, we worried at Marilyn Monroe's recklessness. We dreaded her being recognized by a male customer or a male clerk. A girl would have kept her secret, or so we thought, but no man could resist staring openly at her, following her, and at last, speaking to her. Of course, the blonde actress in the Strand used books wasn't herself, not at all glamorous or sexy or especially blonde in her inconspicuous man's clothing and those salt-stained boots. She might have been anyone, female or male, hardly a Hollywood celebrity, a movie goddess. Yet if you stared, you'd recognize her. If you tried with any imagination, you'd see Marilyn Monroe. It was like a child's game in which you stare at foliage, grass, or clouds in the sky, and suddenly you see a face or a figure, and after that recognition, you can't not see the hidden shape. It's staring you in the face. So too with Marilyn Monroe. Once we saw her, it seemed to us she must be seen and recognized by anyone who happened to glance at her, if any man saw. We were fearful her privacy would be destroyed. Quickly, the blonde actress would become surrounded, mobbed. It was risky and reckless of her to have come to Strand used books by herself, we thought. Sure, she could shop at Tiffany's, maybe. She could stroll through the plaza or Waldorf Astoria. She'd be safe from fans and unwanted admirers in privileged settings on the Upper East Side. But here, in the egalitarian Strand on Broadway and 12th? We were perplexed. Almost, I was annoyed with her taking such chances. But you, gripping my wrist, had another, more subtle thought. She thinks she's like us. You meant a human being, anonymous, female, like us, amid the ordinary, unspectacular customers, predominantly male, of the Strand. And that was the sadness in it. Marilyn Monroe's wish to be like us, for it was impossible, of course. For anyone could have told Marilyn Monroe, even these two girl poets, that it was too late for her in history. Already at age 30, we could calculate afterwards that this was her age. Marilyn Monroe had entered history, and there was no escape from it. Her films, her photos, her face, her figure, her name. To enter history is to be abducted spiritually with no way back. As if lightning were to strike the building that housed the Strand, as if an actual current of electricity were to touch and transform only one individual in the great cavernous space, and that lone individual, by pure chance, it might seem, the caprice of fate, would be the young woman with the blonde braid and the fedora slanted across her face. Why? Why her and not another? You could argue that such a destiny is absurd and undeserved for one individual among many, and logically you would be correct. And yet, Marilyn Monroe has entered history, and you have not. And she will endure, though the young woman with the blonde braid will die. Even should she wish to die, Marilyn Monroe cannot. By this time, the young woman with the blonde braid was carrying an armload of books. We were hoping she'd almost finished and would be leaving soon before strangers' rude eyes lighted upon her and exposed her, but no. She surprised us by heading for a section called Judaica. In that forbidding aisle, which we'd never before entered, there were books in numerous languages: Hebrew, Yiddish, German, Russian, French. Some of these books looked ancient, complete sets of the Talmud, cryptically printed tomes on the Kabbalah. Luckily for us, the titles Marilyn Monroe pulled out were all in English. Jews of Eastern Europe, the Chosen People, A Complete History of the Jews, Jews of the New World. Quickly, Marilyn Monroe placed her bag and books on the floor, sat on a footstool, and leafed through the pages with the frowning intensity of a young girl, as if searching for something urgent, something she knew must be in there. In this uncomfortable posture, she remained for at least 15 minutes, wetting her fingers to turn pages that stuck together, pages that had not been turned, still less read, for decades. She was frowning, yet smiling, too. Faint vertical lines appeared between her eyebrows in the intensity of her concentration. Her eyes moved rapidly along the lines, then returned and moved more slowly. By this time, we were close enough to observe the blonde actress's feverish cheeks and slightly parted moist lips that seemed to move silently. What is she reading in that ancient book? What can possibly mean so much to her? A secret revealed? A secret to save her life? "Hey, you!" a clerk called out in a nasal, insinuating voice. The three of us looked up, startled. But the clerk wasn't talking to us. Not to the blonde actress frowning over the Chosen People, and not to us who were hovering close by. The clerk had caught someone slipping a book into an overcoat pocket. Not an unusual sight at the Strand. After this mild upset, Marilyn Monroe became uneasy. She turned to look frankly at us, as though we tried clumsily to retreat. Her eyes met ours. "She knows." But after a moment, she simply turned back to her book, stubborn and determined to finish what she was reading, while we continued to hover close by, exposed now and blushing, yet feeling protective of her. She has seen us. She knows. She trusts us. We saw that Marilyn Monroe was beautiful in her anonymity, as she had never seemed to us to be beautiful as Marilyn Monroe. All that was makeup, fakery, cartoon sexiness, subtle as a kick in the groin. All that was vulgar and infantile. But this young woman was beautiful without makeup, without even lipstick. In her mannish clothes, her hair in a stubby braid, beautiful. Her skin luminous and pale, and her eyes a startling clear blue. Almost shyly, she glanced back at us to note that we were still there and smiled. "Yes, I see you too. Thank you for not speaking my name." Always, you and I would remember that smile of gratitude and sweetness. Always, you and I would remember that she trusted us, as perhaps we would not have trusted ourselves. So many years later, I'm proud of us. We were so young. Young, headstrong, arrogant, insecure, though brilliant, or so we'd been led to believe. Not that we thought of ourselves as young. You were 19, I was 20. We were mature for our ages, and we were immature. We were intellectually sophisticated and emotionally unpredictable. We revered something we called art, and disdainful of something we called life. We were overly conscious of ourselves, and yet how patient, how protective, watching over Marilyn Monroe, squatting on a footstool in the Judaica stacks as stray customers pushed past muttering, "Excuse me," and not even seeming to notice her, or the two of us standing guard. And at last, a relief, Marilyn Monroe shut the unwieldy book, having decided to buy it, and rose from the footstool, gathering up her many things, and this was a temptation. We held back, not offering to help her carry her things as we so badly wanted to, but only just following at a discreet distance as Marilyn Monroe made her way through the labyrinth of the bookstore to the front counter. Did she glance back at us? Did she understand that you and I were her protectors? If anyone dared to approach her, we intended to intervene. We would push between Marilyn Monroe and whomever it was. Yet, how strange the scene was. None of the other Strand customers, lost in books, took any special notice of her, any more than they took notice of us. Book lovers, especially used book lovers, are not ones to stare curiously at others, but only at books. At the front of the store, it was a long hike. The cashiers would be more alert, we thought. One of them seemed to be watching Marilyn Monroe approach. Did he know? Could he guess? Was he waiting for her? Nearing the front counter and the bright fluorescent lights overhead, Marilyn Monroe seemed, for the first time, to falter. She fumbled to extract out of her shoulder bag a pair of dark glasses, and she managed to put them on. She turned up the collar of her navy coat, lowered her hat brim. Still, she was hesitant, and it was then that I stepped forward and said quietly, "Excuse me. Why don't I buy your books for you? That way you won't have to talk to anyone." The blonde actress stared at me through her oversized dark glasses. Her eyes were only just visible behind the lenses. A shy girl's eyes, startled and grateful. And so I did, with you helping me. Two girl poets, side by side, all brisk and businesslike, making Marilyn Monroe's purchases for her. A total of 16 books, hardcover and paperback, relatively new books, old battered thumb-through books, at a cost of $55.85. A staggering sum. Never in my 2 years of coming into the Strand had I handed over more than a few dollars to the cashier. And this time my hand might have trembled as I pushed $20 bills at him, half expecting the bristly bearded man to interrogate me. "Where'd you get so much money?" But as usual, the cashier hardly gave me a second glance. And Marilyn Monroe, burdened with no books, had already slipped through the turnstile and was awaiting us at the front door. There, when we handed over her purchases in two sturdy bags, she leaned forward. For a breathless moment, we thought she might kiss our cheeks. Instead, she pressed into our surprised hands a slender volume she lifted from one of the bags, Selected Poems of Marianne Moore. We stammered thanks, but already the blonde actress had pulled the fedora down more tightly over her head and had stepped out into the lightly falling snow, headed south on Broadway. We trailed behind her, unable to resist, waiting for her to hail a taxi, but she did not. We knew we must not follow her. By this time, we were giddy with the strain of the past hour, gripping each other's hands in childlike elation. So happy. Oh, oh, God. Marilyn Monroe, she gave us a book. Was any of it real? It was real. We had Selected Poems of Marianne Moore to prove it. That snowy early evening in March at Strand Used Books, that magical evening of Marilyn Monroe, when I kissed you for the first time.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to Samantha Mathis read Three Girls by Joyce Carol Oates. This Pushcart Prize-winning story was originally published in the Georgia Review and is collected in I Am No One You Know, Stories, published by Echo Press, an imprint of HarperCollins. Next week, our Joyce Carol Oates celebration continues with Bill Pullman reading her deeply moving story, O Sable.
Please visit wordtheatre.com, where you can become an annual member of Word Theatre and be an invited guest for a live Zoom with Joyce Carol Oates on Sunday, April the 18th. You can also pick up a single listener ticket, buy books from our partner, bookshop.org, and sign up for our email list. We'll be featuring stories by this marvelous author each week for 7 weeks, and each episode is available for 2 months.
Special thanks to Joyce Carol Oates and her entire team for their support of Word Theatre and the Pushcart Prize, to Jonathan Sachs, who composed our theme music, and to Joseph Cho, our technical director. This is Cedaring Fox.
And I'm Kirsty Pearce in England. Until next week, signing off.